Well, we're joined on the phone now by Mary Relindis Ellis. She is the author of a wonderful new novel called The Bohemian Flats. You may know her as the author of a novel a few years back called The Turtle Warrior. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here tonight. I so enjoyed your book. It was just an amazing mix of romance and conflict and adventure and intrigue and
history
and everything. So richly drawn. And that's why I was very excited to speak with you about it. Now, I understand that the book's premise is somewhat based on some events that happened in your family?
Not really. What it is that I understood what it was like. You know, the usual of immigrant story genre has been of very poor coming over. And my great-grandfather's family came over with some money, and they were somewhat educated.
Okay.
So I knew, and they left. They had the money to get out before my great-grandfather could be inscripted into the Kaiser's Army.
Okay, good.
So that was their, they were tired of religious oppression, and but mostly they couldn't stand the Kaiser. They were looking for democracy and a new place.
All right. So why did you decide to tell this story?
Well, what happened is I was working on a contemporary novel, and the backstory just get to be more backstory, and finally, the writer, Elizabeth McCracken, said, you know, you need to go all the way back and tell that story first.
Oh.
And that's what pushed me back into Germany. However, I saw the Bohemian Flats here in Minneapolis. That history has always intrigued me, just fascinated me. And I was shocked that so many people in the Twin Cities really didn't know about it.
Yes, and probably quite a few of our listeners aren't familiar with it either. Could you explain a little bit about that area and its history?
The Bohemian Flats was an immigrant settlement along the river and way up into the bluffs by the Washington Avenue Bridge and went down to the Pacific North Railroad Bridge at that time, and it stretched up. It was mostly all the mill workers, Washburn Mill, Pillsbury, the woolen mills, and some brewery workers. And it started to become settled after our Civil War. And what happened is it came over because land on the river at that time was not valued. The river was it smelled, you know, things floated down the river, there was bugs. So that was not considered premium real estate. And no one really knew who owned it. No one really cared. So, you know, the mill workers, that's what they could afford. So they ended up building these shanties, and they built right up into the bluffs. And eventually they had streets. They had the lower levee and the upper levee by the Washington Avenue Bridge. And it was according to your income. Wood Street was where the very newest immigrants landed because it was right on the water. In fact, it was so on the water that they had boats next to it tied up to the house because in spring the river would flood. And so you'd leave your house from the top window and get into your boat and float down to the next house and then finally till you could get to dry land.
Wow.
And then the next street was Mill Street and then Cooper Street. And really, the Mill Street was an elite street, and so was Cooper Street, because they made the money that could afford to get them up into the bluffs. And also it came in waves. There was whole chunks of immigrants. Like, it was called Little Ireland, and then it was Little Lithuania, and then predominant the Norwegians and Swedes, and then a lot of Eastern Europeans, and that's the name that stuck, was the Bohemian Flats.
Mm-hmm.
They had quite a mix. Had Italians, had Germans, had the just wave of people coming over before World War One, looking for a new life and a place to start. And, you know, we're so modest in the Midwest. We're too modest in the Midwest. We had the biggest global company in the world at that time. We provided flour to everyone in the world. So we... New York can claim a lot of its history and its true history, but we weren't any shirking lily here. We had a huge global industry, and we had just as many immigrants. We had tremendous immigrant waves that came through the Twin Cities, But, you know, many of them were working at the mills to build up money to go to farms or go north. A lot of people in northern Minnesota, a lot of Finnish people up there. Northern Wisconsin has the same thing, so does the UP. They came through, they started here, or they started in Chicago at the slaughterhouses, but they gradually saved up money and went to their own land. So people up in Grand Marais, you know, may not know it, but people who lived up there may have tracks that lead back to the Bohemian Flats.
That's wonderful. Well, that's one of the pieces of the book I really enjoyed, was the rich mix of immigrants that were in that area. I mean, the Finnish couple, and then, of course, the Germans and Hansa and all the other folks. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was, and I, you know, those wooden steps existed. I saw them for my very self in 1978. My sister and I were walking across the Washington Avenue Bridge. I looked at those steps, and there was a warning sign, you know, do not walk down, because they were very old. But we looked at it, and I thought, what were those steps for? I had no idea that there had been an extraordinary village down there, really a small city. And so it wasn't until 15 years later I read the Minnesota Historical Society's book by the WPA writers, who got in there at the very last in the 1930s and collected all those narratives of people who'd grown up down there and who lived down there. And so I was amazed. I grew up with a lot of ethnicities in northern Wisconsin, and so I knew what it was like to grow up with Czechs, Slovaks, Irish, Italian, Russians, Germans. I mean, so I grew up very much old world European, and in that sense of community that, I mean, I knew women like Elzbieta, and I certainly knew men like Hansa. So that was not the hard part to write. I could identify immediately with that river village.
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt like that piece especially, as well as Magdalena's parents, was about tolerance. Was that something you were
very
striving
much
for?
Right, it was, but it was also my great-grandparents came over, and you know, the Catholic faith, if you just look at the faith, not the church, which is the corporation of the church, the faith is to be tolerant. And they were very devout that way. So they came over, and when they got married, and then after farming for a while, they started a business, they were tolerant. I grew up very proud in my birthplace of Glynn, Wisconsin, because I had this heritage and this family reputation. My great-grandparents were known as being extremely tolerant and great humanitarians. You know, they opened their store at night if somebody needed something. They ran the soup kitchen on their own money during the Depression out of the store. So I grew up with that heritage of practicing tolerance.
Well, it definitely comes through in your book. I enjoyed the whole thing, but I really noticed those pieces, people helping others, even if they were different than them.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, it's true today. I said this about the Midwest. You may not like your neighbor if you're living rural, but you have to get along with your neighbor because, you know, when you need help, they're the nearest people you have to run to. So we might not be as closely, like New York has such a close knit of immigrants, but out here, when they got land, they spread out. But that doesn't mean we still don't have quite a mix of ethnicities.
Mm-hmm. You know? When some of the characters moved to the rural area, was that based on where you grew up?
It was. The original name of the town I was born in was Chippewa Crossing. And I always thought, what a tragedy that they didn't keep that name. Instead, some lumber baron, you know, they gave the town the name of Glidden. But the Chippewa River goes through the town of Glidden.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very reminiscent of that name. And I grew up very close to the Chippewa River, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is a beautiful river. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Mary Relindis Ellis. She's the author of a new book called The Bohemian Flats, just published pretty recently, right, Mary, by University of Minnesota Press?
Yep, May 2nd.
Okay. Can I ask you to read a little bit from the book, one of your favorite passages and mine, so that people can get a feel for your writing?
Okay. This is the first person to come over. It's three young intellectuals that come over from Germany, but the first one to strike out is the much younger brother. It's two brothers, and the much younger brother literally escapes home because he's being threatened with being put into the priesthood. And he meets a German man on board ship, and then when they get to New York, the other German young man says, why would you stay here in New York? It would be like getting your foot in the door but never entering the room. And so he says, go to the Midwest. They have cousins there, you know. it describes how incredible the land is. And so Raymond decides he's gonna stay on the train with Irwin, who talks a lot. And then this is what happens. I mean, he literally comes into Minneapolis and gets off the train and finds a job. They board the train the next day. Irwin talks nonstop. Even when he sleeps in his bunk, words erupt from his lips so that Raymond feels pummeled with noise for the entire journey. Needless to say, he declines the offer to live with Irwin and his cousin, deciding if he has to, he will sleep in a ditch on the outskirts of the city for the silence of mud and grass. After a week of travel, the train enters the city of Minneapolis early one morning, crossing the Mississippi River on a large stone bridge before pulling into the downtown station. Raymond says goodbye to Irwin, promises that they will get together soon, and then enters the station. He asks a white-haired agent where he might find a job. Well, there are several mills. Most here on the river are flour mills, but the one hiring right now is the Pillsbury A, he answers. The station agent directs him towards the steel suspension bridge that crosses from the west side to the east side of Minneapolis. You can't miss it. Big building on Main Street. He, Raymond, walks across the bridge onto a slice of land, an island in the middle of the river called Nicollet, and onto the east bank of the river. The station agent is right. The Pillsbury A Mill is a huge Romanesque-style limestone block building standing 7 stories high on a cobblestone street that runs parallel to the river. He stops for a moment and scans the gray exterior, feels the reverberations under his feet coming, he assumes, from the massive machinery operating inside. He places his hand against an outside wall as if to gauge the rhythm of the building's pulse before he steps inside the tiny office on the first floor where he shouts his inquiry for a job. He can see the clerk's lips move, but can barely hear him. The machinery roars like lions. "The water turbines," the rabbity-looking clerk shouts, pointing to the floor. "Can you read and write?" "Yes." "Sit down and fill this out." Raymond fills out the form, requesting his education and work experience. He hands it to the clerk, who reads it, and then whispers to the young boy who is his office assistant. The boy leads Raymond up 6 flights of stairs to a large room where a short, brawny man with a bushy Swarovski mustache, tends a row of sifting machines. He is nearly bald, the crown of his head tufted with carrot-colored hair. His broad face is the texture of boiled wool, and his upper body is massive, with broad shoulders and well-muscled arms. His legs are thick like his arms, but short, almost too short, it seems, to carry a torso that resembles one of the huge limestone blocks. "The foreman," his young escort says, and then leaves. The man gestures him to the quieter end of the room. "Can you read and write?" he asks in a heavy brogue, examining Raymond with pale blue eyes. Raymond hesitates, unsure of what the man has said. "I speak English," he answers. "So do I," the foreman says, enunciating his word. "I am a Scot. I will speak slower. Can you read and write?" he adds, "in English." "Yes, I can read and write in English, and German and French as well," Raymond answers, his ears rapidly tuning into the man's brogue. "I can fix machinery, too. I come from a large farm in Germany, and a brewery. My father had a brewery." He glances at the automated milling equipment. "I learn fast. I can work one of those." "And so you shall," the foreman says, "after I train you." He holds out a flowery hand. "Name is Gillian McPherson, and this," he continues, "is the most modern flour mill in the world. Thank the Lord that it isn't like the old days, where the flour dust was so bad you'd get white lung." The foreman then briefly explains the machines and tells Raymond to return the next day for work. "Where should I live?" "Where you can afford to," McPherson grins. Raymond stares at him blankly. "I just got off the train," he says. "My Lord, you are fresh. In that case, I would suggest the flats. There's a house on Cooper Street. One of our men just moved out of there, and so there's a vacancy unless you've been beaten to it. Go up to the 2nd Street and keep walking east. You will come to the new Washington Avenue Bridge. Cross the bridge to the west side of the river. You'll see the houses on the river shore on both sides of the bridge. Go to the left side of the bridge. Talk to Prochaska, the grocer. He owns the house, but he rents it out." He catches Raymond by the arm as he turns to go. Prochaska's Czech and a stubborn bastard sometimes. He'll pretend he can't speak German and even English, but he can speak both.
Very nice. Thank you. That was Mary Relindis Ellis reading from her book, The Bohemian Flats. Mary, that's one of the things I think that makes your book so compelling is the level of detail in it is really wonderfully evocative. You can really picture what you're describing. And I'm wondering how, and the historical detail, how, I know you mentioned the history of the Bohemian Flats that you were fascinated by, but how else did you research this?
Well, fortunately, we do have some books. I mean, Minneapolis got rid of so much of its architectural history, and it still continues along that very bad path. But I lived in southeast Minneapolis for 15 years, and so going down to the Pillsbury A, and there's an old bar down there that's been there for hundreds of years, for 100 years at least, not hundreds, Prochna. And that building is very authentic, and it still has the cobblestone streets. So it's small detail like that that helped me kind of pull it together. But then I looked at kind of old buildings, and fortunately the Bohemian Flats was photographed. And so the Historical Society has magnificent photographs. And I had looked at old photographs of the city as well. But I looked up the architecture of those buildings. You know, I've always loved the Pillsbury building. And I love the fact they created the Mill City across the way because the Mill City Museum, it is just a fantastic museum.
Yeah, I heard that. I haven't been there yet, but I'd like to go.
It is just fantastic. And also, I think it was 1984 when the homeless man started a fire and burned down part of the old Washburn Mill. And they, you know, we watched across the river, and I thought, my God, there goes history. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I saw the remnants of those mills. But even after I did a lot of research, I mean, it took me doing a lot of research to realize just what a huge corporation milling was here. I mean, I think what's wonderful about writing about my own backyard and the northern Midwest is that we have an extraordinary history, just extraordinary, and it's not ever been really captured on a national scale.
Hmm.
So, I mean, say Lake Superior, all of that. But no, the cities here had a tremendous history. I wanted to capture that history, and at times, you know, it threatened to kind of swamp the story. But I don't like reading historical novels where I can't evoke place.
Yeah.
And I'm a sophisticated reader, so when I run across reading a novel and I hit an error, and a very big one, it's like, oh, no.
Kind of wrecks it for you. Well, I think you just did an incredibly great job because I could just see it and smell it, and it was really, I mean, the detail is incredible in this book. I think that's one of the great pleasures of the book. Mary, before we let you go, where can people learn more about you and your work? I understand this is your second novel, and you're working on a third now?
I am.
Okay.
I have a website, the usual HTTP, and then it's all one word, lowercase, MaryRelindisEllis.com.
Okay.
And really, if you put it in the search engine, if you just plug in my full name, a lot of stuff will come up. But primarily, my website will be the first at the top.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. And again, I really enjoyed the book. It was a great mix of history and an adventure and some really nice messages of tolerance and so on.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I hope others up there will too.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you.